we're at a stage to where we want to move so fast and test so much and really create a much, much better product and like to have, you know, the best product on the market. So that's when we now to kind of iterate faster, iterate better. We need to now put kind of add complexity to those filters so that we can get good iterations through.
Welcome back to Selkirk TV and the Future of Pickleball Show. I've got a great guest for you today. We've gone right to the home office. We've got Tom Barnes joining us, one of the owners of Selkirk. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Paul.
I am so excited to get you on here. I hear so much within the company about technology and the expansion and development of things. I've looked forward to getting you on the show. Would you give our audience a little bit of an idea of what role you undertake and what are your responsibilities in Selkirk management?
Yeah, so primarily I work in the background, manufacturing, a lot of the engineering concerns, and now R&D. So thinking from the manufacturing perspective, like this is my manufacturing office. We have our USA manufacturing right next door to me. And kind of dealing with the machines and a lot of the processes, quality. And then now we're getting into metrology. So, you know, like the kind of the advanced equipment to test what we're doing out here and, you know, get quantitative data. And then, as well as, like the labs brand kind of taking that over as well. And R&D in general for Selkirk means like quality control and engineering and then the kind of the first half of product development. So,
you know, one of the things that I've been looking forward to is having you both tell me, but to tell my audience as well, you guys have made some major moves in terms of the caliber of testing equipment and things for the process. How is technology factoring into your efforts and the company's efforts in terms of building and creating product?
Yeah, so up until more recently, like maybe in the last 6 months, we kind of took a more traditional product development approach, or just kind of like, you know, test and iterate. At this point, there's a need to start to use more advanced techniques like metrology to measure things and then take that quantitative data that's hopefully objective and then, you know, putting that into some kind of model so that we can start to filter out our testing results and filter out our testing approach via models so we can actually, you know, not have to test as much and test more of the right thing. So if you think of it as like a filter, you have like common sense and that'll filter out some bad ideas. And then you have knowledge base, you know, tribal knowledge, like the things we know, kind of the things we know that works and kind of things we know that don't. And those are good filters. Those happen organically. But now we're at a stage to where we want to move so fast and test so much and really create a much, much better product and like to have, you know, the best product on the market. So that's when we now to kind of iterate faster and iterate better. We need to now put kind of add complexity to those filters so that we can get more good iterations through and then not even touch, you know, bad ideas kind of.
Yeah,
kind of get more good ideas, get less bad ideas. And then if you look at like an iteration tree, you know, you have like tons of ticks that are things you try and then you maybe narrow them down by half and you have to try them again. And you narrow them down by half, try them again, narrow them down by half. Better filters allow you to go from 100 ideas to 3 to 1 versus 100 to 50 to 25. So it just allows you to move much quicker and to not, you know, accidentally filter out good ideas.
You know, it's interesting with all of the history over the last couple of years, particularly since the podcasters have gotten involved with their analysis and their reviews of paddles and things like that. Having been in the sports industry my entire life, I've seen an awful lot of versions of testing and observation, but it always seems so darn subjective. And you see three different guys, they all test the same product and they all come up with different answers. And so I think that the idea of that sort of analysis, one of the things that I think is really kind of important for people to realize is Selkirk's growth has been absolutely meteoric. And a lot of it's come from the standpoint that you guys identify real serious needs. I mean, so many of the modern innovations started with an idea that Selkirk had, and then the industry kind of followed. How do you think that the technology will factor into that going forward?
Oh, man, I mean, I don't know how much of it is a coincidence of taking a more quantitative approach. Like you just mentioned, what you mentioned, like that kind of more subjective, it's more based on opinion, subjective opinion. That's right. Like qualitative. So recently we've been just starting to take, my job has been to putting a more quantitative approach without ignoring the subjective stuff. So kind of taking a more quantitative, more data, more numbers, more objective approach. And just since doing that, and since just being able to be more creative or more proactive, has led us to some things already that we're working on that very excited about for that will largely be released next year. And it's going to completely change what just internally from our perspective, we have this model of how to build a paddle and what kind of materials that normally work and what kind of cores we normally want to do, what kind of structural materials we want to use and how those lay up and how those, come together to make a cohesive structure that's durable, reliable, and in particular cases, high performance. Our internal model for that's going to completely change over the next year. So we're going to have completely different materials, completely different structures, completely different manufacturing processes. And a lot of this is because of it's going to have a high cost ceiling coming in. It's going to be really expensive to do. Both from a quantities of scale perspective and from a just like this is the first time anyone's done this in sporting goods in a lot of cases. We'll have to see how that translates to product early on because, we can't sell something that costs us twice as much to make as we can sell it for. But I'm really excited about 25 because, yes, the new material sets, the new equipment we have in-house and the new partners we found. Let's kind of focus on high performance just because of the cost factor, premium, very premium paddles, pro paddles, for us, they're going to look completely different a year from now, totally different materials, totally different structures. And something that's never been seen before. Playing with these very early prototypes, it's like, oh man, this has got everything. This is great. This is amazing. And that's without even tuning for performance yet. So it's still very early on trying to figure out this new tooling, trying to figure out this new equipment and these new materials. So we're very excited to see what that's going to do next year.
I want to tell you guys about one of the best additions I've got to my game. And it's not another paddle. It's not another shirt. It's my Selkirk Tour Bag. Selkirk bags are designed with tremendous intent. They're to help you organize, to keep things that you need with you where you can get at them whenever you want them. The beauty of the Selkirk bags is they're designed by a company that really thinks first, last, and always about pickleball. They've created a series of bags at all kinds of price points that are tremendously well designed, and frankly, they look really good. Look at the Selkirk bags, not only for what you do courtside, I use my tour bag as my travel bag when I'm going around the country. Selkirk will help you have the best experience you can have. Enjoy it. Thanks so much. You can find all the bags on Selkirk.com's website. So much of what we've had in the industry, and it really is the case of all sports industries, as they get going, everybody wants to use the term technology, their design, their innovation. But in reality, we know a lot of that is very unprovable. It's hard to identify. How will your testing capabilities compare, match, overlap with what USA Pickleball is doing in their trying to establish standards and what UPAA are trying to do, or the organization that they're using? How will your equipment factor or compare?
Yeah, so there's three major avenues and three major applications in, let's just say, testing, like quantitative testing. One is pure research, like just figuring out the physics involved, and then solving assumptions and figuring out the math and how to test for things. The next one is, let's say, compliance or regulatory. So like, okay, now we have this, we have governing bodies that have equipment standards, and we need to adhere to those equipment standards. And also, like, from us, an ethical perspective, we don't design around those standards. We actually adhere to the thesis, even if the equipment being used and the techniques being used are do not remotely represent that thesis or that purpose of testing well. And a lot of the research applies well to that. For the longest time, we were the only people doing research. Recently, UPAA has engaged with an academic organization to do research. We haven't seen any of the outcomes of that, but hopefully that adds much more to what they've been doing, because some people know I like had to go after them for complete incompetence in the testing side and in the objective physics side of things, and the objective, like, this is not how this works, and this is not how you test, and this is not how this is not right, like this is foolish. Fortunately, hopefully they're going in the right direction technically, but an interesting thing just with UPA in particular is I was very frustrated with the technical side. I've been battling it since the day one of their inception, when they went to the first event, first MLP event back in Daytona Beach, almost 2 years ago now. And after going after them, like, technically, like, hey, you got to solve these really basic, extremely bad things you're doing. It revealed a lot of cracks non-technically. And now kind of the issue with UPAA is non-technical, like organizational issues, like more real issues. And then, like, looking at USAP, had a lot of technical issues with them as well. Better organization. So to kind of boil it down without going to, detailed, is a lot that's happening right now leaves a lot to be desired in both the technical and non-technical aspects of, let's just say, equipment standards, and not only the technical aspect of said standards, but also the implementation. And USAP has had better outcomes. But I'm looking forward to see what UPAA can do, but we're concerned of kind of conflicts of interest there and kind of, they saying one thing and then doing another, and that being a common theme. So much so that something I want to talk about, which I know I didn't bring it up beforehand, but something I'm working on is I spoke to the vast majority of manufacturers, probably the leadership of probably 60 to 80% of all pickleball manufacturers, like, let's say, grouped by revenue, right? And I did some polling and just asked some questions and, like, non-leading questions and open-ended questions. And it became very clear that like, manufacturers in general need kind of more of a united front, a representation, because you have people that come up who are creating the rules. We have absolutely no comprehension of how pickleball powers are actually made and how they work, which is wild. So, and then when we get put on, let's say, a committee like the UPAA Manufacturers Advisory Committee, and we're supposed to advise, we're not allowed to advise. It's all like a front. It's like, they say, oh, this Manufacturers Advisory Committee, the last one we had, I had all these polling results. We're going to present this polling results and present the issues we have as manufacturers, because we're here to advise, right? And they left us on mute. We were not allowed to talk. And I told, like, hey, I had this, me and everyone on this board basically got together and have something to present, and they wouldn't let us talk. So that was very frustrating. So that's kind of the organizational stuff, because even if they're doing better on the technical side, it's much worse on the non-technical side than it was even probably a year ago. So there's things like that that are issues. So we're starting this thing called the Pickleball Equipment Manufacturers Association. It's a trade association for people in the pickleball industry that actually design and create in-house or contract manufacture their own designs. So and that's an important distinction because there's a lot of Alibaba rebranders out there. There's a lot of people that are, just not actually adding value. They're just throwing a brand name on something and not right. and just taking it and throwing it out there, which is very common. Most of the engineering that happens comes directly out of the factories. There's very, very few brands that are actually doing their own design and engineering. It's mostly they just offload it to someone else to do it and don't really care. And then just make something better. They get something better and they sell it. So, we're really excited about like this manufacturing association. I try to get a hold of everyone I can that's like a relevant manufacturer, people that I know about and can find. I'm still missing a lot of people. So like kind of like whoever listens to this, if you're a relevant manufacturer, reach out to me. Should be pretty easy to find my contact information. Worst case, just find me on LinkedIn and send me something so I can get you hooked into that. But really excited to finally have like a trade association that can ethically represent the manufacturer's needs.
And that is something that is a natural maturation process of our industry. Every other sporting goods industry that gets into, whether it's baseball bats or golf clubs or tennis rack, every industry has a manufacturer's association because mm-hmm. it needs to do just that. It needs to have its own voice as to how things go. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you in terms of having your own testing equipment, so much of the discussion out in the marketplace that I hear of all the time is about core crushing. And how does a paddle mm-hmm. test when it's brand new, but does it change? And I don't know that there's anybody that's been able to begin to address what is that change. You know, so how is a paddle, perhaps, let's say, after it's a month old, is it different than it was? And is it in compliance or out of compliance? Is that something that can be a factor for you guys?
Yeah, 100%. We design, we absolutely see core crush as a defect, like it's a manufacturing failure. So like that's something you definitely want to design out. And we have good practice now to design that out, both from an engineering perspective and from we use non-destructive inspection techniques like computed tomography. That's a CT scanner. It's basically a bunch of X-rays, and then you X-ray that paddle a bunch of different times and spin the paddle around and take lots of like thousands and thousands of slices, and you can put that together and then see inside of the paddle very detailed. To let's say in the case of a honeycomb polypropylene honeycomb core, so like those little cells, but they're like literally little straws, right, put on end, and you can go in there and easily see if all those straws are intact. You can look at it from the side and make sure that they're a good cylinder and their walls are vertical, and then you can look at it from the top and make sure that they're relatively round or like properly hexagonal, and making sure that they're not separating from each other, because the reason core crush happens is either the mold's too hot, so you melt it kind of, or you get it past you get it past its kind of plastic state, and you destroy the mechanical properties, and it basically melts or allows it to crush, or you apply too much pressure or combination of both. And that can be you're pushing it down too hard, or there's too much material in the mold. And so that's very easy to design out, because either like don't do it too hot, don't push it too hard, and don't put too much material in it. And also, you know, make sure epoxy sets are going to play nice with your materials and your temps. And
but pressures. Would it then be, since you're describing how you can make sure it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. is that something could, I mean, we've got paddles that we're finding are too hot. They're not approved by some of the organizations. Could design be done where you're consciously trying to make a paddle that will core crush because some characteristics will come out of that?
Yeah. And like one of the brands said that they did that on purpose, but realistically, it is absolutely a defect. But with that defect, you get this really interesting wear curve. So talking about like, hey, we want to make a product that's like, let's say compliance. We have this top line of compliance. You can only get this faster. We only responsibly think we want to make it this fast, because any faster is going to cause problems in play. So like we want to be like right below that line and see a very gradual degradation, like as gradual as possible. The problem is when you allow failures to happen or design in failures, like failure points, it kind of does this, like it starts, here's the line. It really starts like below the line in a lot of cases. And then when you in break in, it skyrockets, like it gets really performant and then it's way above the line. And it also drops off a lot. Anybody who's played softball with composite bats, like competitively, everyone knows this, like breaking in the bats, back doctors, all that kind of stuff. You're getting that bat as hot as possible, right to the brink of failure. And it happens to make it really powerful. It's hard to control, but it's very powerful. That kind of wear curve though is clearly a defect. So the problem is that failure of engineering, or that allowing the structure to fail, it gives you some brief advantage because it gets really powerful. And then like what people are doing now, which is insane, is they're it used to be called like floating core. So not allowing the core to be bonded to the face, so that it could squish and allow core crush very easily, and just make it, it's basically like a box of bolts, right? And then that does give you a really good collision dynamics, really high coefficient restitution, which is how efficient is the collision. I would like it's the real side of the trampoline effect, and then that can give you power and our use of power or of the term power, and like yeah, so you get that short term effect, but like it's a defect, and you have to like pros are rolling through these paddles that are meant to fail like every day, if not every match, and it's wild how many hundreds of paddles are getting churned through just because they're not constructed, they're not a good structure. So it's that's like a huge problem, because and the core of it is like they're meant to design around the testing, because they don't test these things in situ, they don't actually bring these things back to the lab to verify it. So rarely happens, it doesn't matter. So you can just create a paddle that passes the initial static testing, which by the way isn't high efficacy, so it doesn't really work, and then as soon as it gets out on the field and gets broken in, it becomes way too irresponsibly powerful. And then nothing's being done to address it. So, that's where really dynamic, the word dynamic testing is coming from. At these, what we're doing now is I call it static characterization. It's basically like, let's just take a thing and subjectively poke and prod it and get some numbers and pretend like that equates to the real world. It doesn't. Static characterization does not tell you anything about what a person holding that thing and hitting it with ball width in the real world. It tells you maybe 10 or 20% of that picture. So what we're moving is dynamic testing, where we're trying to emulate what happens in the real world, like emulate the ball paddle dynamics, and therefore get a better picture of how this thing's actually going to do in the real world. And that's a much tougher question. That's the kind of equipment we have. We have this dynamic testing. We've been working with academic institutes in more advanced testing technically for like 2 or 3 years now. We started with balls. We're way ahead of the curve there in general in the metrology side. And it's very frustrating having all that context of how a ball and paddle behaves, and the right way to test things, and then not seeing that being carried out by the people who have to make the rules. So that's something that I'm also hoping, like PIMA, that trade association can contribute to, is bringing up the technical aptitude of everyone, and then just doing research that people can see and we can use to bring up like the testing, so it stops being a problem. But it's a bummer that the private industry, the manufacturers, have to fix this and always have to deal with this, because we're the highest impacted, us and the players, and we have to fix it, and then because no one can seem to do a good enough job to fix it themselves, so it's very frustrating.
Well, it is. I think of other industries that I've been in, and what the trade associations have actually been kind of a monitor of, is controlling what the offshore factories do, because everybody's always trying to come up with their point of differentiation, or we've mm-hmm. got this amazing thing that nobody else could figure out. But where we're trying to have a sport where there are actual guidelines and steerage, I would wonder if by Selkirk being able to actually have this equipment to test something, they can see product that's out in the field and prove that it's violating the rules or something.
Yeah.
Agencies or the governing bodies who are setting the standards, do they have that capability?
I mean, the capability to test things and verify they're out of spec. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they will. They have the technical capability. Basically, as of January 1st, that's when the standards should be. That's when their ability to use their machines effectively should be good enough to properly assess those things, so that they don't get tons of false positives and tons of false negatives. However, it's all about implementation, right? Like, the technical side is going much better in this sport. Like, this time last year, nightmare. Like, it was wild how poor everything was, and some of still and a lot of the things we're still doing today. But I'm very optimistic from where we'll be a year from now, just because all the design arounds that happen against the thesis of testing, against that the purpose of testing, forced them to like now have to fix the problem, because since their testing was so bad, they had no mech. Since their testing was so bad, and they had no good qualitative mechanism to enforce. They have to now reactively put in all this dynamic testing, all this complex. They have to lay on all this complexity very fast. It's skilled labor, physics problems, math problems, mechatronic control problems, and do that very fast. And that is very hard to do. Like, we've been working on it for a while, and realistically, like, it's only been a relatively small number of weeks where we can do it well. And that's so, like, to try to do it overnight it doesn't work, especially if you don't have the right people in place or even like enough money to buy the right equipment or work with the right people. So technically they have the hardware capability. I don't know how that's going to manifest once people have to test things and make decisions. And I still don't know what these machines output that they have. Like, I've got a few vague numbers. We've got some few vague baselines, but we have no way of knowing if their equipment is even remotely well integrated, like if it'll perform and actually give real objective numbers. Because, like, dynamic testing is great when you get a more objective number, but you can have quantitative numbers that don't mean anything. So completely relative. You can do fancy things. You can do interesting things with relative data sets that are helpful. But, man, like, when you're trying to do objective testing that, hey, this is the limit for power, anything above it's too fast, anything below it's too low, and then that doesn't translate to the real world, like, that's what we're really concerned about. So, because there's an absurd amount of complexity and factors to even get 80% of a picture of what that paddle and ball are actually doing. So I kind of know I'm kind of like jumping around a bit, but going back to it, yes, they have like the hardware capability. Whether they have the full technological capability, no one knows yet. Okay. I don't think they even know. But hopefully January 1st, April, like each start of each quarter next year, at least like, so April, January 1st, April 1st, July 1st are going to be big benchmarks for when this stuff matters and gets implemented. And that's when we'll start to see change in like our end, and then that'll filter probably like 3 months later to users, to customers. But yeah, anyway, I'm circling back. They have the they have the hardware. Don't know if they have the capability. So even if they did have the capability, I don't know if they have how well the integration will go, like how they will actually do it, if they'll actually enforce on both sides, or if like, you know, UPAA will enforce in a way that is very nefarious, basically.
You know,
so,
it is.
Or just incompetent. So our same thing with USP. We don't know if like their enforcement is going to work.
Well, I think that some of the things, there's really so much history of standards and testing in other sports, in other industries. You mentioned the baseball industry, the golf industry. You know, sort of interesting. I know something about some things that have gone on there, and they basically are setting standards 18 months in advance of a change so that the manufacturers can adapt. They can deal with inventory flows, mm-hmm. Production cycles. So I think the stuff that you're talking about doing is so necessary in our sport, where we can get back to, yes, there's a standard, manufacturers mm-hmm. follow it. That's the goal and objective, is to be within the standards. And then, how do we now make things better for the player? And I really want to ask you, typically the questions about testing and equipment always are sort of oriented to the premium, the high performance, the pro player response. How does Selkirk go about, you develop pickleball paddles that run from $60 a paddle all the way to the top of the line. How do you identify what the needs of different player sets are and different skill sets?
Yeah, there's absolutely an outsized focus on pros and like the people who actually need, like pros are like pros and I don't know, 5.5s and above are like only the people who actually need like some of these capabilities of this equipment, or in a lot of cases, like the paddles that are engineered to fail, they're the only ones that can actually handle it because they're so hard to use, because the structure is all jumbled up, that only the best players can actually, you know, get an outsized value out of them. But we firmly, you have to hit like all market segments, but like for us, like 80% of players are the ones who are the normal players, like the people you go out to your local court and it's a 3-5 game, if not 3-0 to 4-0 game, if you go by rating, and just like your average people are just average families that want to get out and play. And this is what's awesome about pickleball is you see great grandkids playing with great grandmas, and they're out, they don't care about if their paddle is this or that or the other thing. They just want to play. So like we want to, like, that was the goal of the SLK brand, was to get those people into pickleball and do it with a piece of equipment that's quality, that's going to play well. Like it's not a bummer to use. And if they have any issues with it, we're going to replace it for them. No questions asked, have the best customer service in the game, and just make sure that they're supported as much as we can support them. And with amateur player or with recreational players, like that's largely like, just get them a good value, get them a great value piece of equipment, get them a great value paddle, get them balls that are durable, that don't break every 5 minutes, and give them a paddle that will last for years. And if anything happens to be wrong with any of that, yeah, like buy the Pro S1s. We'll get you, if one of them breaks, if your four pack breaks, send them back and we'll get you another one. And make sure their paddle works and just really support the average person, because the average person is 80-90% of this game. I think that gets really unappreciated, like of how the manufacturer decisions, equipment decisions affect, you know, the average person. And there's absolutely this insider bias towards just the pros and just the high octane players. And that's not the industry. The industry is everyone else. there's this unequal weighting, but we really care about the high performance premium stuff, but like we cannot forget about, you know, the people who just want to sit there and play pickleball and don't really care about much else. So you have to support them with equipment that's going to work. And if there's any issues, we take care of them. No questions asked, as fast as possible.
Well, I love the idea of your being able to statistically and scientifically analyze what the paddles are doing. That's got to factor into feeding the whole range of prices, in terms of we can make a better moderately priced paddle than we did before because we know more, and we could do the same thing with our entry level paddles. We can do more. And I think that that's really exciting. I want to take just a moment out here. If you're watching this and you like these kinds of interviews and you like the kind of information that our show is bringing to people, hit the like button, subscribe to this show. These are the kind of leaders of the industry that we're bringing together to be able to help and inform and steer the industry where it's going. You know, Tom, I want to ask you a question about, I've been very involved with interviewing a lot of the global leaders and people that are in the different association organizations. Does Selkirk have a position, or do they see a value in how the global governance is coming together? Do you guys have any opinions on that?
I mean, we kind of need to figure, like, I'm aware of several of the international bodies, you know, between like what's going on in Oceania, India, Vietnam, things like that. But maybe I'm hyper-focused on the domestic stuff, like the USA okay. stuff, because like that's a long way to go still. The industry is moving so fast. Everyone's playing catch up. My initial concern is USAP and more so UPAA. Like if those don't run well, and most likely those will be either like the seeding point or the reference for everyone else. And if that reference is suboptimal, it's going to harm international growth. And even like point, like think like conflict of interest, like if we have some private company that's making the rules and that's for self-serving revenue rule for revenue goals, guess what we can't do? We can't go into the Olympics. We cannot go into the Olympics if that's how everything works. If equipment standards is just a revenue stream and not something to actually make the sport safe and to not, and to make it and to keep it fun, like that could destroy our entire sport. Like we know racquetball went the way of regulatory capture. That was an industry that's growing really fast like ours. It had a lot less benefits than pickleball. Like it wasn't as easy to play. It wasn't as convenient. The courts were much more expensive. The equipment wasn't much different in price. And that entire sport got ruined by regulatory capture, by the regulators becoming the regulated, by the manufacturers paying off the people making the rules, which ended up with the paddles getting so powerful that it ruined the entire game. I don't know if you played racquetball lately, but it's scary to move, get into that court. It's so fast. I'm an athletic person. I played racquet sports. I played all sports growing up, and I don't not like get in that room with racquetball because it's too fast. It's scary. So now you lose that dynamic of kids playing with their dads even, or and like young people and older people being able to play because it just doesn't work anymore. And that's something that like we're really like Pima is very worried about our sport getting most members that will be part of Pima that kind of like we're working on like the founding members right now. And I literally just sent out a letter that's like, here's like the ethics, like here's a code of ethics and here's the mission, here's the premise. Right. And like literally just got that. It's very early on. It's very nascent, but it's like we're worried about like that because if we don't do it right here, then it's not going to go any better overseas unless we have people there who actually know what they're doing, which I think there's a lot of cases there's people overseas doing a better job than we are.
I recently saw the interview that Rob Nunnery did about having played in India, and he was commenting that he was playing against some players that had paddles that were obviously off the charts because they over there they don't yet have any kind of governance or any kind of standardization. And so I'm one of the things that I see as being very important to our short-term sport as well as intermediate and long-term is the fact that until we get a governing body that can then be the conduit to taking this kind of testing information and data and saying we're going to enforce that the same product standards are happening around the world. Obviously, the US and Canada are where kind of everything is starting and growing because of the size and the budgets right to do it. So it'll be sort of interesting to see where that goes. The issue in terms of unification in the sport is that something? So if you're able to organize a manufacturers association where the overall pie is served by how big can the sport get around the world, do you think that the association would be a resource for providing information and direction for how the sport is played worldwide?
I mean, there's definitely some crossover. So this is like the goal of Pima is like the manufacturer's perspective. And like we want, like manufacturers want the sport to grow. We want this to be the biggest sport in the world maybe someday, right? And for me, I think it's common sense, but it seems like this isn't the case in practice. We're like, hey, if like we all do a good job and responsibly grow the sport, then we all win. But if you do these actions that harm other people and literally damage things just so you carve out this little niche that only you can be in because you just figured out you could design around the rules and then just not
design around. I love your choice.
Design arounds are so easy. Like you have no idea how bad the current testing is. We could be cheating so hard and so easily and never get in trouble for it because we'd be within the rules. And it's got to stop. Like, and I'm hoping that dynamic testing will do that. But or be a component to that. But man, like, yeah, so we firmly like, hey, if we do grow the sport responsibly, we don't allow regulatory capture to happen, which we've got a small taste of several months back. Like, if we don't allow that to happen, then, hey, if the tide rises, so do all boats. Like, everyone will win. We'll win. You'll win. All the other manufacturers will win. The players themselves will win. The people who actually matter to the game, the players, will win. You'll get better product that's actually more fun to play against other people with. And then USPA will win. UPA will win. Everyone will win. Internationally win. Like, if we grow the sport and don't ruin it via short-sighted self-interest, then everyone will win. And it's amazing. Like, that's obviously common sense, but it's very hard to deal with a certain, like, bad actors in the sport that are causing harm out of pure short-sighted quarter-to-quarter bottom-line self-interest. And it's got to stop. And talking to all the other manufacturers, 95% of all the manufacturers I've talked with, like, yeah, like, we agree. Like, yeah, no, we want the sport to grow. We want it responsible. We don't want to ruin the game. Almost everyone's on the same page. So that's a very easy thing. So, like, and the manufacturers can help drive this because we're the ones making the equipment and putting it out there. So, like, we're a huge link in the chain of growing the sport responsibly from the way of, like, hey, let's build a product that's safe. Like, let's make sure it doesn't have, like, not made with extremely dangerous materials. Let's make sure that it doesn't fall apart and hurt somebody. Let's make sure it doesn't hit ball so fast that we're hurting people. Let's make sure it doesn't have other weird characteristics that cause harm. Like vibration is through the paddle equipment is like causes like tennis elbow. So like, hey, can we do things that like make these things more medically safe long-term, you know, to help cut in half the extremely active players that could get tennis elbow, right? Or people with pre-existing injuries. And that's something like the manufacturers can help drive. And we can drive that from a research perspective, like actually like in academia can help us drive that. We've partnered with them, with academia, to do this done. Best sports equipment lab, best sports science lab in the industry. And we're partnering with the international, I'm trying to partner with the International Sports Engineering Association, like just like get like being able, so we get have more resources to do a better job and to grow this sport responsibly. Because like we've always, day one, Virgil business started in our dad's basement, and then that turned into Selkirk Sport. And like we grew grassroots. We bag dealers, grassroots, real people, and we want to keep growing the sport in by what players like want, and not do that in a way that doesn't harm everyone. So we're really excited to do that. Like, the sport's going that way in general. It's just a matter of there's some bumps in the road that need to be called out, and like a lot of it, just like people just don't know. Like, people don't know what happens, goes on. People don't know what happens in these sketchy backroom board meetings. We have to have more transparency. And I really hope the goal of PIMA is it's going to be a transparent org. Like, we're going to talk about what's going on, and we're going to have this code of ethics. And if what you're doing is actively causing harm, we're going to take an evidence-based look at that. As one of the charter items is evidence-based approach, like quantitative, good qualitative, good quantitative evidence that, hey, what we're doing here is causing problems. We as an industry need to fix it. So we're really excited about what that could do. And then at the end of the day, like, it's not a punitive measure, so you can't force people to do anything, but at least, at the very least, if they're doing something illegal, okay, maybe then we can like deal with it that way. And then if they're doing something unethical, we can at least make it public and make it like, hey, this is bad, here's why, and not everyone agrees, yeah. Right? And I think that's a measure that people don't have, because manufacturers have this weird, like, us, there's this weird inorganic us against them metric that's been kind of fomented, and it's very frustrating. We're like, I meet all these people, and it's like, oh, these are great people. Oh man, like, I just made friends with this brand guy, like, awesome. Got these three other video calls last week, and it's like, oh, these guys are awesome. Like, these guys are friends, and we're all on the same page. We're all trying to do the same thing, and we're not. I'm not trying to, you know, like, poke and prod you and subvert you to harm you so that I have an outsized value. That's insane. Like, that is going to destroy our industry, and that's happening a lot right now.
Yeah. So the things that you're describing, unfortunately, I've seen numerous times in my long history in the sporting goods industry. Mm-hmm. And they all lead to diminishing the success of the sport. And the thing that I could, you know, my goal and passion in life is, how do we grow this thing to its ultimate end? And it's about the holistic components, about goodness, health, camaraderie, community. And if we get so wrapped up, I mean, I was I wasn't in the softball industry when the aluminum bat thing really started to become a problem, but I mean, kids were getting hurt, adults pitching.
Pitchers especially, yeah.
I mean, the bats got so hot, and it wasn't until the industry said, we can't do this, we'll kill the sport, you know. And so I love to see that. I really appreciate the time that you've taken here, Tom. And before we sign off, and I'm going to ask you to kind of give me any kind of future views of what Selkirk might be doing in the future, I want to let everybody know this is Selkirk TV. This channel is the most comprehensive app in the pickleball space. There's more great podcasts. There's coaching, teaching, live broadcasts of many of the PPA events are available on your telephone. Go to the Selkirk TV app. With the commercial out of the way, Tom, guide me if you've got any insights that you can talk about where Selkirk's going in the future.
Yeah, so more apps, more products that you can use in your daily life to play more pickleball, play pickleball better, and just kind of make it easier to get out there and work with people. A lot of new product coming down. Like I said, like we had this new R&D approach, and we had some traditional approach products come through that really excited with. Like 007 was a really good start in that. That was a really fun project. We did some interesting things there with more traditional materials outside of that titanium and the new coating system. Just next year, like early Q1, maybe Q2 next year, releasing some really interesting, just game, like totally different product that I think people will love. Like it's like butter to play with, and it performs well, and there's a lot of things we can do with it. And I'm more on the manufacturing side, so I'm not as tied into every initiative we're doing as well. So I'm not exactly sure what some of the levels of confidentiality are entirely.
Sure. I'm certainly not trying to put you on the spot.
I don't want to go out there, but yeah, we're really excited about a lot of new soft goods coming out, like a really amazing apparel line coming out at least the next fall. And then a lot of new high performance product, interesting product. Really excited what we're doing here in R&D. We're going to talk more about, like, this is an aspect. I think I've done on a few other podcasts, like one like live stream, and we're really excited to like start talking about this stuff more, because everyone thinks that what's going on is like, everyone thinks what they're doing is super special and super secret. And a lot of it's not. A lot of it's like stuff that everyone is largely doing. So like, we want to talk about that more and just kind of give more insights, like what is going on in the industry. Like I want to do that more. My brothers want to do that more. Pima can help with that. And then talking to other manufacturers and other bodies, other companies in the space, like it's clear, like, hey guys, like what we're doing is like, you're breeding all this weird conspiracy and then we're like, people are hiding real conspiracy because we're just not talking about stuff. And that we're really excited to make this sport more open, can kind of more understand, like, what are the manufacturers doing and what are we doing this matter? And then creating a feedback loop between us and everyone else so that manufacturers can do a better job, better product, better communication, mm-hmm. a better job with the governing bodies. Governing bodies can work, maybe even like one day work better with themselves and like that kind of thing. It would be amazing. So like just make the sport more cohesive and kind of bring back some of that camaraderie we've lost over the last several years.
Well, Tom, let me tell you, I'm personally really glad to get engineering perspectives, because we've got all kinds of smoke and mirrors, sales, marketing stories that go on in the industry. It's really, I love the fact that you guys are taking the technical, strategic approach to really understanding this. Taking the leadership role on getting a manufacturers association will do nothing but help the sport, both domestically and internationally. And those are the things that I love to see, because they all lead to how the sport will grow. And the things that I do in the sport and now doing them globally, so many questions are, how do we replicate what's gone on in America? How do we achieve that kind of market penetration? We need leadership. We need steerage to help those countries be able to grow. They'll grow faster than we've ever been able to grow, because now there's the model in America of how it can be. So that's very nice. I want to thank you again, Tom. This has been great to have you on the show. And I look forward to seeing you the next time we cross paths at a tournament.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Yeah, I really appreciate it. It was nice finding
you. You bet.